Today, we speak with homeopath and educator Pat Deacon in Canada. She has agreed to speak on a topic that's very close to my heart, which is about some of the different prescribing styles we find in homeopathy. Something I always want to make clear to our listeners is that you're going to have a different experience with each homeopath you go to, and it's important to go to a practitioner you really feel comfortable with and you have really good rapport with, and then stick with them until your complaint has resolved. And depending on the complaint, this may mean weeks or months or years. But as you continue to build that relationship with your practitioner, you will eventually get to a very deep level of healing on a mental, emotional, physical, and even spiritual level. We have so many different prescribing styles which we can draw on, and Pat will go over some of them today. And we have over 8,000 different remedies which we can use to help our clients. So homeopathy really has no limits. I hope you enjoy the episode.
Welcome to the Homeopathy Hangout podcast, where we discuss all things homeopathy from around the world. And now, your host, Eugenie Kruger.
Homies, and a very warm welcome to Homeopathy Hangout. Today, we are hanging out with the lovely Pat Deacon, all the way from Canada. Welcome, Pat.
Thank you for inviting me, Eugenie. Hello, everybody out there.
It's lovely to have you on today. Now, we're going to be chatting about different prescribing styles today. But before we do, I was wondering, Pat, can you tell our listeners a little bit about how you discovered homeopathy?
Absolutely. I, like many homeopaths I know, found homeopathy through my children. My eldest child, pretty much after birth, was absolutely covered with eczema. We actually rehoused our cats. We removed everything from the house that we thought, you know, might be a problem. We did the conventional route all the way and actually got no joy. The cortisone creams didn't even work for him. So we explored every alternative we could find, which at that point was not very many, because it was, you know, pre-internet. This is, we're talking about the late 70s, early 80s, where they're just, the world was a very different place. Eventually, though, we ended up being referred to a homeopath by three different alternative practitioners we've been to. It said the only person who's going to help you is this homeopath, Lewis Klein, who was at that time one of pretty much the only homeopaths operating in Canada. We were fortunately living in Vancouver, which is where he was. And we had no idea what homeopathy was. We walked into the room. My husband and I, my son was three. He walked straight across the room. And this is my son, who did not like strangers at the time, straight across the room and planted himself on Lou's lap.
Oh.
And I, wow. You know, and at that time, Lou himself didn't have kids. And he wasn't, you know, it wasn't like he was a emanating Santa Claus or something, you know, I mean, and he sat there for an hour and a half, and I just found the consultation mind-blowing. I just felt like he asked all kinds of questions I'd never thought about before. What side of the bed does he sleep on? You know, things about him that I'd never really even thought about before, you know, and I felt like at the end of the consultation, we knew our son in a whole different way. And I thought that was amazing. And Lou said, the eczema is going to be there for another few months, but it's not going to be bothering him. You know, we went off with these little sugar pills and came back 6 weeks later with a child we'd never met before. You know, he was happy. Our son had been angry from the time he was born. He was happy, content, cooperative. And yes, the eczema was there, but it wasn't bothering him. He started wearing shorts, which he always refused to do. He was sleeping at night. You know, we bought bright red sheets for him because he, you know, just rip himself to shreds at night. Mm. Just as he said, a few months later, the eczema actually left. But the significant thing was it never even occurred to us that we could change personality or change, you know, we thought we were just going for something physical. Well, so at that point, I was completely smitten with homeopathy, and I read everything I could and, you know, bought the books I could find and joined a local study group. And then I stalled because there was nowhere to study in Canada. There were no schools at the time. Other people in the study group were all single with no children. And so they were free to move to England or go down to the States. And so, but even in the States at that time, you had to have some sort of medical qualification in order to study homeopathy. And then you did homeopathy later. So, and I had no interest in getting a medical qualification. I had no interest in being a naturopath, which is what a lot of people were doing. I knew I wanted to do homeopathy. So anyway, I put it on the shelf. I just figured, you know, if it's meant to be, it's meant to be. And at the moment I have a young family and, you know, I have to focus on them. And at the time I was working part-time at a feminist women's health center. So I was fitting diaphragms and cervical caps and doing pregnancy counseling. And we also had a resource center there for women in the city where people would come and fill out forms and their doctors. It was back in the days when people could actually choose the doctors they went to. I don't know what it's like in Australia, but in Canada, most Canadians don't have a GP. We have miles long waiting lists actually to have a GP. But at the time, people could actually choose their GP, and they'd come in, again, pre-internet, you know, women would come in and fill out these forms and know who they were going to. And we did a lot of, post-hysterectomy counseling, and there were birth collectives that were there. We supported women seeing midwives and having home births, which was illegal in Canada at the time, both home births and midwives. So it was a pretty happening place. We had a government grant. And at one time, there were actually 14 of us working there. So, but I would just, you know, from the time I had this homeopathic experience, I would just refer all these women to Lou, because I thought, yeah, there's nothing else for them. You know, I mean, if he can do this for my kid with his eczema, I'm sure he can help all these women with the problems that they have. And, you know, that just became a real interest for me. So fast forward 10 years, we've moved across the country from British Columbia to Ontario. And settled, promised the kids we wouldn't move again. And out of the blue, my husband gets an invitation to apply for a job in London. And, you know, he threw out the first three that arrived. And then when the fourth one came, he thought, well, I better actually take this seriously. I kind of, you know, this sort of looks like my name is on this job. Sure enough, he got it. And we moved to England. We lived there for about 10 years. And it meant I could.
Wow.
Yeah, because at that point, there still were no colleges in Canada. By the time we came back 10 years later, there were. Anyway, so that was wonderful. I mm-hmm. you know, joined a study group right away, found a homeopath, and studied at a wonderful little college that doesn't exist anymore called Purton House School of Homeopathy, where we met in our principal's living room, group of 18.
Wow.
It was fabulous. And we met every week. That was the other thing. It wasn't the sort of 2 or 3 day weekend. And we met every week, almost every week of the year. Mm. And then had to fit our clinical work and what have you in around that. But I felt like I got a really good grounding, you know, and that's what it was, though. It was a grounding. And when we graduated, our principal said, so now the real learning starts. Mm. Go and taste every kind of homeopathy you can and figure out what your own practice is going to be, you know. And so for some people, that was a very discouraging thing after 4 years of hard work and lots of money. And in my case, it involved quite a bit of traveling, but it was all worth it. So at that time in England, there was a spectrum of homeopathy. You know, at one end of the spectrum was what was called the practical school. And they didn't do a lot of the sort of deep psychological, classical prescribing. They were more into practical remedies that worked, sometimes in combination with each other, but more allopathic in the sense that it was like, these remedies are for the liver. You can take a combination of them to heal your liver, you know, this, you know, like that. Mm-hmm. And then at the other end of the spectrum were these strictly classical people who had, and my school was somewhere in the middle, you know, we had a classical training, which meant one remedy at a time. And we basically learned what I think of as a box of remedies, you know, which was the way people practiced at that time. There was the polycrest. And that box might be 10 remedies or 20 remedies or 50 remedies or 200 remedies, depending on the practitioner. You know, and people tended to sort of expand their box as the years went through. But basically, people were being fit into a slot. And I saw that early on, even before I started studying homeopathy, and it always bothered me. It was the one big question I had that was never answered in my 4 years was, you know, if we all are individuals, we're all snowflakes, why is it that everybody's getting Natura Muriaticum at some time? You know, why are we using such a small number of remedies? At the moment, we have 7,500 remedies, I think, in the entire Materia Medica. So why would you settle for 200, you know? Mm. And I think part of it was at the time, we didn't have the internet. You know, the internet for me has revolutionized homeopathy in so many ways. It's been a very good thing for homeopathy. With the internet, we were able to get databases that were searchable and expensive. But, you know, as Lou would always say, Lou Klein, the homeopath that we went to, he would always say, well, the people that were practicing at the time of James Tyler Kent, who was one of the foremost American homeopaths around the turn of the last century, those practitioners would spend a whole year's income on a repertory, which is a large book.
Wow.
Dictionary. So really, you know, you kind of have to have a perspective. We're a unique audience. Mm-hmm. Small, unique audience that are actually going to be purchasing these. So I meant to say, too, I practiced in England a lot. I had a very busy practice from the get-go. And then we came back to Canada, and I got off the plane and walked into a NASH, North American Society of Homeopaths meeting, where Lou was the keynote speaker. And I had already signed up for his postgraduate course at that point. I was burnt out. So I went for my box of remedies to, as my principal suggested, taste some other things. And what I found was I needed those other things to supplement what I was doing. So I started using tissue salts and combination remedies and herbal tinctures and incorporating those into my practice because my box was not big enough. Yeah, I did that and really burnt out. After about 4 years, I'd move people from one remedy in the box to another remedy in the box, and then I'd add on with these other things. And it wasn't what I wanted to do. And I saw in that postgraduate training that Lou was doing the possibility of opening up the box to the entire Materia Medica. Mm. So I embarked on that process for another 3 years of postgraduate study. And it was very difficult because I was quite confident in what I was doing. And it was like I had to go through a process of breaking down what I thought I knew and to open it up to new things and very different way of practicing. And it did require systems, you know. So when I'm teaching students now, what I say to them, you can operate out of a box of remedies that you're comfortable with. I know lots of people that do that. Still, lots of homeopaths practice that way. For me, it was limiting. And it also meant that I would hear people say things like, oh, classical homeopathy doesn't treat that condition. You know, what nonsense. Homeopathy can treat anything. You just have to find the right remedy. So we came back to Canada in 1999. Since then, I've embarked on learning as many systems as I can to allow me to access all those remedies. And I have found I don't need combination remedies. I don't need tissue salt. I mean, they all have their place. But in my own practice, I'm always working on get that single remedy that's actually going to heal my patient at the deepest level possible. So, you know, it's meant really getting a good handle on the periodic table, for instance. Very brilliant Dutch homeopath, Jan Scholten, around 25 years ago, like around the time that I had started studying, came up with the idea that the periodic table is the table of life for him. As, mm-hmm. you know, trained as a scientist, the periodic table is the table of life. And he said to himself, well, if it's the table of life, why is it not something we use in homeopathy? So what he did was to actually take the periodic table and to map the known homeopathic remedies, the ones that are in the box, Natrum Muriaticum, Calicarbonicum, mm-hmm. the mineral remedies that were known, to map them and to look at their symptoms. And then once he had them all on the map, what he realized was the connections between them and was able to draw some conclusions about themes that went both vertically and horizontally across the periodic table. Mm. And then once he'd done that, he was able to start proving, which is the process by which we find out what's in a homeopathic remedy, the gaps. So rhenium suddenly became part of the homeopathic Materia Medica, ruthenium, calcarium muriaticum, and then combinations. So calcarium, not just carbonicum or calcarea sulfuricum, but calcarium muriaticum and calcarea nitricum. And this, he was able to figure out what the meaning of the salts, the muriaticums, the nitricums, the what have you, that were then now added onto remedies that they hadn't been added onto before. And they had, what do you know, they had a whole new meaning, and they fit, you know, cases in a different way and in a deeper way. Everything I look at, you know, any case I look at, I put it through different mental filters. And one of them for me is, where is this person on the periodic table? Mm-hmm. What place in their lives are they at? You know, and you know, which stage on the periodic table? Anyway, then, you know, as people got a handle on that, He then explored a whole row on the periodic table that nobody knew anything about, the lanthanides, and discovered that this unknown hidden part of the periodic table was just what we needed for autoimmune diseases and children with the kind of things that homeopaths see today. You know, lots and lots of people. We see a lot of people with autoimmune diseases. Mm-hmm. We see children who are on the autism spectrum disorder with an alphabet of ADD, ADHD, you know, various so-called behavioral disorders. And those are places where the lanthanides are absolutely brilliant. You know, and they are made, they are used in life to as components of computers, colors in a television screen. I mean, the things that we use that are unique to our time. So it's totally appropriate that they would be the right remedies for conditions that are fairly new in history.
Yeah. We could almost call them man-made diseases.
Yeah. Some of them have to do with just the way we live our lives, you know, this particular, where we are in history. And you know, I really believe that there is an evolutionary process with remedies, and that they need to be adapt to the time and the diseases that people are presenting. Mm. So that would be one that I use. I also draw extensively on my studies with Lou, who is just a brilliant homeopath, and whose work, you know, if you haven't studied with him directly, a lot of the information, he is trying to write as much as he can now. He's not practicing at the moment, and he's, you know, working on his books. But
can I do a quick little shout out as well to his online learning platform, Zomeo, which I've used as well, Zhomeo. And that's for professional homeopaths to get development. But there is, I mean, I haven't been able to really even scratch the surface because there's so much material in there for you to study. It's really opened my mind to a lot of different topics.
Yeah. 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 Zomeo is fantastic. And it's, he's not doing the HMC Master Clinician course anymore. Mm. He is just focusing on Zomeo, and he's not actually doing there's access to all his old, or all the, not his old, but his video that he produced.
Yeah.
But now he's actually turned it over to people that have studied with him to colleagues to present their own material. And a lot of them are people that don't present anywhere else. So absolutely. It's a brilliant resource for everybody, that any homeopaths that are listening, if you're not subscribing to Zomeo, I really recommend, you know, if you want to expand your own Materia Medica, it's a very good way of doing it.
Absolutely.
So what I'm sharing with you is basically how I work by introducing you to all these different things. Mm-hmm. So back to Jan Schulten. So he went from the lanthanides to then going, hang on a minute. I mean, there's this whole untapped world of plants. And really, there's not, up until Jan, there was very little good information about plants.
Mm-hmm.
So he took the periodic table and then came up with another structure, which is far more complex. So I always say to people, you have to get a handle on the periodic table first before you move on to the plants, because he's added new categories. And of course, the plants are so complicated. And part of what makes them so complicated is there are different classification systems. Mm. They change all the time, you know? So another person that I study with, who came out with her work around the same time, is, again, a brilliant biologist, homeopath, a botanist homeopath from Israel, Michal Yakir. And she also has a table of plants, but it's completely different from Jan's. And it's based on a different classification system.
Oh my gosh.
So usually I recommend to people that they get their head around one system first. Mm. And then, you know, if they want to, personally, I use both of them. I love them both. And they have different functions for me. So I use the periodic table. I use those two. What are the other? The other big tool that I use is colors.
I've got that. I've never used it, but I've got it in the clinic.
It's called The Colors in Homeopathy, and it was the story of it is Ulrich Welt, who is a German homeopath. His homeopath passed away, and Ulrich discovered that he had spent 35 years of his practice collecting his patients' favorite colors and their handwriting style.
Mm.
And he did his prescribing partly on the basis of that information, because what he started to find was that people that needed certain remedies would choose certain colors, and that their handwriting bore a similar style to each other. So when I heard about it, I was fascinated. I actually heard about it while I was reading Jan Schulten's book, because I noticed this cryptic 14A, 17C, what have you, on the cases. And I was thinking, well, what is that? And sure enough, you know, he explains it's this color system. So it's a really beautiful thing. Because what Ulrich did was to take his teacher and his homeopaths information and then put it in an accessible form so that other people could use it. And again, with the beauty of the internet, he or somebody else from his practice goes online every week and does corrections to the list of colors. So there's, I don't know, probably 1,000 remedies that are mapped out on the colors now at this point, but it's an updating, something that gets updated regularly. So it's a very good system. And there's a bunch of us around the world who are using it and feeding information into him from our own practices. So somebody does really well on Kanayam. You know, we feed that case into him and say, and then he has a system of, for people that are familiar with a homeopathic repertory, there's a way of classifying symptoms, you know, in different categories. So for instance, a black type symptom, what we call a black type symptom, is one where a number of homeopaths have reported to Ulrich, oh, you know, so my one patient, there may be 10 other homeopaths who've said, oh, yes, I've seen that color coming up in with respect to that remedy. And so that becomes a black type symptom because a lot of people have had that experience. If it's just one person, he'll put it in a plain type and then goes back and checks with the person to see whether their patient was continuing to do well months later, or if he received that same information from other people, then it might go up to another category. So anyway, I just mentioned, and I use the handwriting, I collect the handwriting, but I haven't found it as useful a system. So it's not for me.
Quick question for me, Pat. Do you happen to know if that, because I have that book, but I haven't used it as I would have liked to. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just sitting there on the shelf, really. Is there a good online course that explains how to really properly use that?
Well, if you're a Zomio member, you can go in and find. Oh, I've actually done one, and Marcus Quintosh, who actually works with Ulrich Welt, and he is the guy who usually checks them. He has also done one. So I think Marcus did too, and I did too. So if you just go through the archives, you'll find them.
Okay. Okay.
So every homeopath finds their own way of doing things. And I do find that people are, as I said about England, they are on a spectrum, you know, and some people are more rigid and other people are more loose. So when you go to see a homeopath, and I'm talking about people that have, you know, done the training and graduated from a college and usually done other training, and we're real, I mean, most of the homeopaths I know are bibliophiles, you know, as soon as the new books are out, we collect them, the information. And we also attend seminars and we attend, right now it's webinars, and we've had so many webinars. It's been the heyday of homeopathy for me because we can see people on Zoom, which is just the most brilliant thing. I was doing most of my practice on Zoom already, but when COVID hit, it meant I had to do it 100% of the time, which is what I wanted to do anyway, and I'm not going back. So it allowed that, which means people all around the world have access to all kinds of homeopaths that they couldn't have before. Mm-hmm. People all around the world that don't live somewhere where a homeopath lives, that, you know, are able to access somebody. And you know, we can go online and look at people's websites and choose somebody that resonates with us as a practitioner, which is brilliant. But also, I've gone to conferences that I couldn't have gone to, you know, because of the cost, you know, in different parts of the world. I go to webinars all over the world. It's just the most wonderful thing. So I've learned so much in the last couple of years. It's been a really wonderful time in that respect.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, COVID has been so hard for so many people, but I think that there are certain people who found it a real
blessing in disguise. Yeah.
Yeah. So speaking of, say, a registered homeopath, there is no standard way of practicing. You know, everybody it's very individual and everybody uses what works for them. India is the heart of homeopathy. And if they have thousands of colleges, hundreds of thousands of practitioners, and they normally, but again, it varies a lot, but a lot of them are they train as doctors. They're very allopathic in their thinking. You know, you have this condition, you know, you use these remedies. They tend to work from a very small box, but they know that box back and forth, like backwards and forwards, like nobody else I know. They learn by rote, so they memorize the remedies, you know. So it's a well-utilized box. And I would say that's the majority of the Indian homeopaths. And then within that community, though, you've got different teachers who do things different ways. I mean, there's one fellow that some of your mums may be familiar with, Banerjee, who has a protocol for everything. You've got breast cancer, right? you know, here are the remedies and here's how you take them. You know, there's no individualization. It's just, you know, straight up, these are the remedies for these conditions. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work, you know, and the times it doesn't work are, you know, are when you've got a remedy that's just completely has no relationship to that person at all.
Yeah.
But, you know, it has and it's a very popular method for a lot of home prescribers to use because it is so black and white, cut and dried. Mm. And then on the other end of the spectrum in India, you have people like Rajan Sankaran, who taught something which was initially called the sensation method, and it's kind of morphed into other names and other things. But the idea was that you basically took one theme that a person would mention. You know, just an example.
They might say they feel stuck.
I'm stuck in my life, or I have a headache that's killing me. And they would just go through that headache until basically they got into a place where the person was saying stuff that didn't make any sense. Mm. But what it was doing was leading to the remedy, to a place where the person, if it's done very well, the person will actually describe the remedy that they need, which is kind of an amazing process, but very few people do it well. And I, having seen it not done well lots of times, I only use it when it's really appropriate in my own practice.
And there's definitely parts of that you could use, hey? So if you're not necessarily using that prescribing style by itself, there's certainly parts you could pull out of it. And that's what I do as well, just little parts.
Yeah, exactly. But that's very, you know, that couldn't be more different than the way most Indian homeopathic doctors who are trained as doctors, you know, they don't go through medical school to practice homeopathy in India. And they go through homeopathic medical school, whereas, you know, other doctors will be trained in Ayurvedic medicine. Mm. They will also train as doctors, but they are using a traditional ancient Indian medicine. And then others will be in an allopathic stream where they train that way. So, yeah, so that's a very different situation than the West, where, in fact, what we call lay homeopathy or professional homeopathy only came into existence in the 1970s. And part of what facilitated that was that there was a plane crash. At that point, homeopathy was only practiced by a small number of doctors, MDs, in England. And a whole group of them went off to a conference in Belgium and they had a plane crash. Many of them died. And as a result, it just kind of decimated the professional homeopathic community. And in the wings were two different groups of so-called lay people, you know, non-medically trained people, who were studying with a man called John DeMonte and Thomas Malm. And they had been studying with them for a few years. And suddenly it was their time to practice, you know. And one of them founded the first homeopathic college in London for people that weren't medical. The Society of Homeopaths was formed at that time. And suddenly, you know, the world was open to homeopaths who were not medical doctors, and that changed everything, you know, and, you know, that spread all around the world. Now there are homeopaths who are not medical doctors all over the world. And so it's also spread homeopathy, and it's allowed homeopathy to grow in a different way. Mm. And I think it's quite a wonderful thing. So,
absolutely. Pat, I have a bit of an interesting question for you. So do you think that it's important to match the prescribing style of the practitioner up to the client? For our listeners listening to this, is it important for them to ask their potential new practitioner what sort of prescribing styles they use before they go to that person?
I think it's a perfectly legitimate question. I get that question usually from people who've been to homeopaths before. Mm. Most people come in cold. They don't know what they don't exactly. You know, and people that have seen other homeopaths, and I have a lot of people that have seen other homeopaths before, they'll come in and they'll say, what are you asking me about colors? You know, my homeopath didn't ask me anything about colors. Why is that important? You know, or I'll prescribe a remedy they've never heard of. And they're like, well, what's that remedy all about? You know, and why I don't know. This, it's not what they're expecting. So we talk through it. And, you know, I mean, if it really gets to a place where they're not comfortable with it, then I'm very happy to refer them to somebody else who's more along the style of homeopath that they're used to. Mm. But, you know, there's a spectrum. So, you know, on the one hand, you have people who are dowsing for remedies, you know, and are choosing them that way, or using an electronic machine that's going to tell them what remedies the person needs. And they may be given as many as 15 remedies a day to take, you know. So, you know, that's one end of the spectrum. And And then there's another end of the spectrum, which is very rigid about classical homeopathy. And, you know, you give one pill and that's it for 7 weeks, or, you know, and you're not to touch the remedy at any other time. And you know, I mean, that's a very different style. And then all kinds of people in between, and people have their favorite teachers, you know. So for many of the homeopaths in the West, it's the teachers from India that they like. Rajan Chakravarti, who I mentioned, Divya Shabra, the Joshis, these are all big teachers from India who come to the West. And then there are other people who study with, as I met people I've mentioned, Mikhail Yakir, Jan Schulten, and then various other kind of not as well-known homeopaths, but all of whom teach and you know, are known to the homeopathic community, all of whom practice very differently. Everybody's their own style, their own combination of things that works for them and that they feel an affinity to. I got into real hot water at one point with a group of homeopaths online that was prescribing for children with autism. And I was really, and you know, mums were writing in, right? And this mom had written in that she had been to two different homeopaths, and one had prescribed pills as opposed to liquids. And she understood from some of the people in this group that it was absolutely verboten to give a pill. It had to be a liquid, and the only way to prescribe for children with autism was, and she was asking the group, what did I do? Should I like not go back to this homeopath? And I stuck my neck out and said, absolutely, if you felt comfortable with that homeopath, of course go back to that homeopath. It's just a different way of prescribing. And I actually, it was huge. It was such a huge deal, you know, that I had dared question one of the demigods on the site who had said, only liquid prescriptions. So, you know, there are people like that have, you do it this way and, you know, or they have very complicated ways of liquid prescribing. You give it at 10 o'clock in the morning and you have 10 glasses lined up and you take a teaspoon of one and then you take, you know, and I, poor patients. I mean, and then there's other people who have really long lists about all the, you can't eat peppermint and you can't eat, you know, you can't drink a coffee and you can't use Tiger Balm. You know, those injunctions came from a long piece by Hahnemann in which he also talked about garlic and spiced chocolate, all kinds of things that nobody talked about that were also part of the list and were equally important with too. Yeah. And in reality, we've just seen from experience, not that my personal perspective, none of that stuff matters. And all it does is it puts off patients.
Exactly. I found exactly the same.
There's homeopaths that won't treat people who are on. Yeah. And you know, there are homeopaths that won't treat people who are on allopathic medication. They will not treat people who've had radiation and chemotherapy for cancer. There are people that, you know, so everybody has their rules, you know, and personally, I think the less rules, the better. You know, homeopathy is a very flexible. But on the other hand, there are patients who are more comfortable with a very strict prescriber.
Completely agree.
Has lots of rule, you know, and prescribes in a way that's comfortable to them. So, I do think there is a certain matching of the style of the homeopath and the style of the patient, you know. And I have sometimes seen people who get to 6 homeopaths before they've come to me just because they want to find, and a lot of us actually offer a free session. I mean, I offer a half hour free session, and I know a lot of my colleagues do that, or 10 minutes, 15. At least you can meet the homeopath before you put out all that money and have a sense of whether you like their personality and whether they feel like somebody you can trust your life to, you know, which is what you're doing. You know, it's very private information that you're sharing with your homeopath, and whether you feel that that's a person you can, you know, entrust that information with. So,
So I guess the moral of the story here is that all of us homeopaths prescribe very differently. And at the end of the day, you need to find somebody that you have good rapport with. When you're speaking with that person, your energy just, you know, just mishmashes together and you feel comfortable with that person and you feel you can share with them things that you might not have shared with anyone else, so they can really get to the core of how to heal you. So don't let the prescribing style of the practitioner put you off and just find somebody that you really resonate with. Pat, how can our listeners get hold of you? Where can they find you?
Oh, my website is patdeacon.com.
And just for a little bit of fun here at the end, what are your top 3 favorite homeopathic remedies and why?
Good question. I have to say number one would be gelsemium. Gelsemium is a remedy that some of you will know is one of the top influenza remedies. It's a remedy that's been used a lot in COVID. It adapts itself to so many situations that I think people run into acutely. You know, the person who is so scared to go to the doctor or the dentist that their knees turn to rubber and they can't stand anymore. That's gelsemium, you know, or that can't get out of the bathroom, you know, because they keep having diarrhea or feeling like they're going to have diarrhea or they just have to pee constantly, you know, before they go and see the doctor or perform somewhere, or, you know, it's a big remedy for childbirth. It's a remedy for women that it's in the rubric fear of an ordeal. So for fear of childbirth, you know, it's the unknown and terrifies a lot of women, and their cervixes will close right up and they won't open to let the baby out. So gelsemium is just a wonderful remedy for opening the cervix and calming down the woman, you know. And often during the birth process, during labor, a woman will say, I can't do it anymore, you know, and will say, I just want to stop it. I want to go back. I don't want to have this baby. And, you know, and gelsemium is like magic in a moment like that. So yeah, it's, you know, there's so many, the flu thing is very big, but there's also all these other, and related to flu, I should say too, it's also a remedy I've used for people who've been sick with flu, like who, you know, post-viral conditions where they hadn't had they didn't know anything about homeopathy when they were originally sick. And they, you know, we sometimes have to go back to gelsemium. It's the remedy that they needed for the virus that they had in the first place. And they may have been sick for 20 years, you know, and with chronic fatigue syndrome, and gelsemium is there as a remedy. So that would be my number one. Well, I mean, what would we do without arnica? You know, I'm sure that's on most people's list of top three remedies. And again, it's a remedy that's used for so many conditions. You know, it's you can take arnica as a jet lag remedy. You can take arnica for the trauma of witnessing an accident. You know, the again, one of those remedies that's useful sometimes years later, somebody that had an accident 15 years ago and they still dream about it. The arnica will stop that dream cycle, you know.
And at the moment, we're using arnica a lot for blood clots.
Oh, okay. Okay. So a new situation. Yeah. And it will stop bleeding. I mean, I've been seeing a lot of people with nosebleeds, kind of out of the blue, had nosebleeds for years. Either after, you know, after they've had COVID or whatever, that suddenly this comes up as a related to the blood clots, actually. The opposite. You can't stop bleeding. Arnica's the remedy, you know, and it's,
And lucky number three?
Oh, boy. Buddleia.
Oh, yes. Somebody talking about Buddleia. Tell us about Buddleia.
Buddleia.
I love it.
Yeah. Okay. So Buddleia is a new remedy, a newly proven remedy. And it was proven, again, provings are a whole other topic, but there are many ways in which remedies are proven. And it is part of a group of remedies that a group of people in England have proved through meditation. And it tends to be used a lot by that community of people and not by others.
I use it a lot. It's made from the butterfly bush.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. The Buddleia. I'm sure that grows in Australia.
It does. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah. When we moved from BC to Ontario, we had tried to grow one and, you know, it didn't survive the winter. It's just a bit of an odd plant that people really know there. But in the UK, when we lived in the UK and when we lived in BC, we always had Buddleia bushes. And yeah, so I would say Buddleia, it's a trauma remedy. It's a really brilliant remedy for trauma and grief. And interestingly, the butterflies, one of the big indications for butterflies are children who've been abused. So there's this whole piece of, again, of trauma that's, you know, related to Buddleia. And I think it's one of the most brilliant grief remedies and is really, really underused.
Definitely. And it has this ability to heal the planet. It's a remedy I give to a lot of my clients. And I say to them, when you go walking in the bush, go throw some remedies in the streams just to help heal the planet. It was so lovely to speak with you today, Pat. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom. I really appreciate it. And I will chat again very soon.
Okay. All right, Eugenie. Have a good rest of the day, everybody. And thank you for asking me.
Thanks so much.